You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Joining us, that was the Hot Texas Swing Band with Hot Texas.
Alex Dormont.
Yeah, it's opening and we'll hear him again closing the show. And we're delighted you're here for another week. We have an amazing guest to talk about, with tonight. Jim, you were mentioning earlier something about, what was that, a white limo?
No, there's a black Mercedes parked out there with a couple of swarthy looking guys in there. And I was told by somebody that a white Mercedes is more dangerous.
Yeah, we're going to bring on our guest, Adam Sykes, right now. And he's going to tell us what kind of a Mercedes should we keep our eyes open for.
Definitely a later model one. Late model one, a few dents on the side. That's the one to be careful for.
Welcome, Adam. Welcome, Adam. This is our featured guest tonight, Adam Sykes. Where are you joining us from?
I'm calling in from just outside L.A. in Yorba Linda in Southern California.
Oh, we've been just to the Nixon birthplace house, I think. Yes,
the Nixon Library is 7 minutes from my house.
Yeah. Oh my gosh!
There you go.
Well, we're delighted to have you. We're going to hear more about Adam in just a moment. But this gentleman is a thriller espionage writer, and you will want to pick up and read anything he writes. And be prepared to not go to bed, because you will not want to miss a word, a page. So let's get started. Go ahead.
You may not be able to go to bed. All the lights will have to be on.
Well, that's why you keep reading all night until the lights come back on. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Adam.
Okay, we have a bio here. We'll read this, and then you can fill us in on what we didn't put in here. Adam Sykes is a novelist, nonfiction author, and his debut thriller, Landslide, was a finalist for the National Indie Excellence Awards. There we go. Mm-hmm. His latest novel is The Underhanded, just released April 2024, last month. Prior to taking up the pen, Adam served for over 25 years in U.S. national security and is a former paramilitary officer with the CIA. And is a U.S. Marine Corps combat veteran. He has lived and operated in the Middle East, Central Asia, Africa, Europe, and Russia. He holds an MA in history from Georgetown and resides in Southern California. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
You know, some authors say you should, write about what you're familiar with.
What you know.
Here's a guy that writes about where he lives, what he's done.
Well, and we really appreciate you providing the little bio, because, I think, Adam, with your background, if we went looking for something, there'd be lots of things probably crossed out, or what's that called? Redacted?
Redacted.
Yeah, we would have a hard time putting it together. So thank you for providing that.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, I was undercover for a number of years, but then later in my time at the agency, I came out of cover. And so now it's on my resume, so you can find it on my resume.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm sure you did just share a little bit more about yourself, but you have such an interesting background. Is there something you'd love to share with us that we didn't include in your bio that you'd like our readers to know?
That's always one of the hardest questions, because I think, well, what could I say? And so I build Legos.
I
build Lego bricks with my two kids, and that's kind of my favorite thing. I have a son who's 9 years old, and a daughter who's 4, about to be 5, very precocious. And that's one of the things we like to do. So for my birthday or Christmas or Father's Day, I get Lego sets from them that they want to build with me. And then we, you know, sit at the kitchen table and build these things.
And then do you explode them?
No, we haven't got into that. We haven't got into blowing them up yet. We're still in the young in the building phase. So we're working on the Millennium Falcon right now because we're huge Star Wars.
Wow. Oh, wow. Oh, how fun is that? I know you've got some questions.
Well, you might talk just a little bit about your Marine background. You're still a Silver Star recipient, so you've done some serious work there.
I joined the Marine Corps in 1995, right out of high school. As soon as I graduated, found myself in San Diego on what's called the Yellow Footprints at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot. And within 15 minutes of standing on the Yellow Footprints, I was seriously thinking about what did I just get myself into? I enjoyed it. I spent 10 years in the Marine Corps. And, you know, right out of the gates, I found myself exposed to the conflict over in Bosnia and the Balkans. In 1996, as a 19-year-old kid, literally couldn't go down to the local bar to buy a beer. But here we are over in the Balkans. So I got exposure there. And then found myself living in Moscow, Russia for a year with the security guard program. And then 9/11 happened and the whole world changed. Involved with the invasion of Iraq and went back for a return trip because, that's kind of what they did, was in Ramadi and Fallujah. And it was a very interesting time. There were some very bad days, but I don't regret it.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
I know you tie in, there's a couple of things you tie into the story in underhanded that has to do with Bosnia. We kind of won't bring it into the right now. We don't want to spoil alerts, but we can see how that you use your own background, to tell the story.
Yeah.
You know, you were a federal military officer for the CIA. Now, we figure you can tell a little something about CIA, but not too much. So
right.
That's not the Culinary Institute of America either. I don't think.
Often confused. I was very fortunate. We got a phone call after the Marine Corps from a gentleman who did a 30-minute interview with me, and had no idea where he was calling from. He didn't say where he was calling from, but we do this interview. And by the end of it, you kind of put two and two together. There's certain types of language that people from the intelligence and special operation community use. So I kind of figured it was somebody from one of the three-letter agencies. But it wasn't until about a year and a half later, as I'm going through the selection process and all the interviews and poking and prodding, that I'm finally in a face-to-face interview. I'd had some previous face-to-face interviews, but I'm in a face-to-face interview, finally in a government building. And I'm being interviewed by someone who was one of the leaders in the paramilitary operations community. And I did lean across the table at one point. I said, "What am I interviewing for?" And that's where he explained it and said, "We are looking at you to be a paramilitary operations officer to conduct covert action on behalf of the United States government." Mm-hmm. Now, covert action has a very specific definition that's under Title 50 of the U.S. Code. And what it is, it's economic, diplomatic, military-like, or other types of activities that we do abroad where we are intentionally hiding the hand or disguising the hand or participation of the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So as a paramilitary officer, it is the special operations world for covert action. And that's what I went on to do for a number of years, doing special operations and military-like operations around the world.
How does this stop? Do they just tell you assignment is over now, or we want somebody younger? How does that end?
Well, we would generally, the folks that are in that community are generally a little older. You had to have extensive prior military experience and leadership positions, and at the time, multiple combat tours, but they look at you as being a little older, so you have the experience and the maturity to make some of the decisions we would make. Oftentimes you're operating alone or maybe with one other person, and the decisions that you were doing and the acts you were involved in, could have international implications on a massive scale. So you had to be able to think and operate at that level. The idea of shoot, move, communicate, medicate at a tier one level for special operations, you know, that was part of it, but that it was also this other decision-making mm-hmm. side of it. Could you be trusted to make these decisions with little direction in ambiguous, high-stress environments, and that could have global implications?
Mm-hmm. Very good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you work a kind of a 9-to-5 schedule, or are you kind of 24/7? How did that work?
It would depend where I was. There are some places where it was 24/7, particularly when you're undercover. Yeah. That would be 24/7. Okay. At home, yeah, it was a little more of a 9-to-5. I could go home to my house and my family.
Yeah. How when you're operating that way, Adam, how do you learn? I'm guessing you learn how to somehow compartmentalize. Maybe that's not the right word. Be where you need to be in the role you're playing, but then there's Adam, and there's another life for you. Is that a hard thing, or when you're on a mission, you just know this is what I'm doing, and I'll meet Adam later? I mean, how do you work that?
It is very immersive. You have to assume the identity of your cover, of what you're doing, which mm-hmm. it would be, you know, different people with different jobs. But mm-hmm. the best lies are the ones told closest to the truth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your cover and how you lived it, it would be based partially on who you were, but you'd alter different things to fit the profile that you needed to fit. For me, I did have to immerse myself in it. And when I was away, I would believe myself and think of myself as a different person. And that was the identity. I was no longer Adam Sykes. I would be somebody else, and, you know, slept it, you know, lived it all the time. And you have to maintain your focus. You have to be very intentional about what you're doing and not allow distractions or other stressors, maybe from your personal life, get in the way of what you're doing. Because you won't come back to that. You want to get home. Have to be focused.
Yeah. How long have you been writing?
So I've considered myself a writer my entire life. You know, when I started, you know, in high school, I was in creative writing, and then academically been writing, professionally I've been writing. But when it comes to writing novels, I started drafting the first scene of a manuscript that fortunately will never be published because it was atrocious. But in 2012 is when I started drafting the first scene of this book. And I probably rewrote that scene 40 times. I just kept working and playing with it, and I enjoyed it. And that scene then turned into a manuscript. And then that manuscript, you know, landed me to work with an editor. I got to work with Robert Ludlum's editor, this gentleman by the name of Richard Merrick, mm-hmm. who was retired at this point. And I got to work with him for about a year. And that was just a wonderful experience. And then that manuscript that got me my agent. And then that, you know, eventually landed me a publisher. And so I started writing in 2012.
Okay. We're going to ask now the first question, and we're going to be getting into this book in greater detail in a little bit. This is just sort of introductory. So congratulations, because The Underhanded was just released in April. When we first began communicating with you, you knew it was coming. We had a book, we had a PDF, we knew. But congratulations, it's very exciting, the launch of a new book. How has it felt to have this baby finally born?
So this is the third book that I've gotten published. But each time I will say it is a really an experience that's just uplifting on so many different levels. You have this sense of completion, especially when you get to hold the finished the book for the first time. It's a physical copy in your hand. And you do, you know, this manuscript itself probably took about a year and a half, 2 years to write. So all that work, all that time, all that scratching out, all that going back and forth trying to make this story that really just started with a small idea, you know, when it finally comes to fruition is really neat.
Yeah. So when
there's a lot of history in this book, you know, that you write. You know, you got your master's degree in history from Georgetown. I just want to ask, what was the specialty that you kind of studied there, you know, for your degree?
So I studied what's called the Atlantic world. And so the Atlantic world is essentially bookended by 1492 and then just about to the start of World War I. And it's about the intersection, interaction, the collision, the conflicts, the relationships, and the evolution between North America, South America, Africa, and Europe. So it's the peoples and all the interactions with these different cultures and different groups coming together in some ways. You know, the slave trade obviously is a huge part of this. But then you have, you know, Europeans meeting the indigenous populations of North and South America. And it's a different way of looking at history rather than saying, well, I'm a colonial historian or I'm a British historian. You're looking at all the different variables and influences from this other perspective to see how the world evolved.
And I can see the roots of that knowledge in this book. So briefly, where does this story take place and when?
So this story takes place in contemporary times. You know, it's set in the present world. But as you were saying, Jim, it has ties all the way back to the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. And that's kind of the initial historical thread, starting there and then traveling through World War I, World War II, the Cold War, up until the present, where we have this conspiracy that the two main characters are going up against.
So your main character is Professor William Randolph Dresden. What a wonderful name. You know, that's just
a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. And he is written in first person. He's the only character written in first person. What has he recently written and publicly presented, and what happened?
So in the academic historical world, there, for a longest time, historians, and this was, you know, decades and decades ago, would focus on this, the great man theory, where it was about Napoleon and how he influenced the world. It was about Roosevelt and how he drove events. And so what I did with William Dresden was, there are all these people in the world that are not the main figures. They are the people, the aides or the deputies. They're working on the side. Yet these people have tremendous influence and opportunities to drive their own agendas. And so William, in this story, he is talking about how these lesser known personalities had a very monumental impact on historical events, and how the Franco-Prussian War shaped a lot of events in the 20th century. But other people didn't really care for his research. And so he's been smeared and put on the rack academically, and is now in the south of France trying to recover from the professional thrashing that he got.
Yes, when you write about those individuals that had the impact, I couldn't help but think, oh, those were the influencers. Those were, you know, it's just like you talk about William Hearst and Pulitzer, and they were sort of the yellow page journalists. That's kind of like what we could translate today into, I don't know, false news and blogging and whatever. And so all those guys and gals that you're talking about from, you know, 1870 and up, they were the influencers of the day, but they were quiet.
They were quiet.
Well, it makes me a little concerned. I think about our present day government, and I'm thinking, what's going on there between people one or two layers down for the president? What are they up to? Yeah. We really don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Let's see. Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. We're going to go and hear where your books, one of the places your books are available, and that's the Out West Shop affiliate bookshop page. And then when we come back, we're going to get into greater detail about this book, The Underhanded. So stay right where you are, and we'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer,
explore curated book lists, and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Wonder Woman the Writer with special guest Adam Sykes. We're talking about his book, The Underhanded. And we were just talking about what goes on behind the scenes, and it's not always the way it looks.
So, do you want to ask about the Strasbourg?
The Strasbourg Covenants. What are they?
What's that all about?
So, I crafted this conspiracy because I love stories that will tie in the historical component and a nice conspiracy and tie that into maybe modern times or something. Yeah. The Strasbourg Executive is a group of 11 officials, and they are behind the scenes. They are intentionally anonymous. And what they do is they use ideas and methods of influence to pursue their agenda. Mm-hmm. So one of the major elements of this story in The Underhanded is big data, social media, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and how with today's technology, people who do not have, say, the power, they don't run a newspaper or they're not the head of a government, yet with all this information, how we consume that information, they're able to influence and drive agendas. And that's what the Strasbourg Executive is about. It's a neo-fascist organization for extreme nationalism. And they were inspired out of the Franco-Prussian War, which was a conflict between France and Prussia at the time. And they wanted to increase that national identity for various European countries. So all they might have different backgrounds or come from different nationalities, they pursue this nationalistic agenda with some other components in there.
Mm-hmm. I say it's ripped from the headlines. Let's talk about a little bit of the technique that you wove into this story. For instance, you crisscross Europe. We're back and forth to a lot of different countries. How did you kind of decide where to put the action and where to return to and where to go to next?
So I consider myself very fortunate that I had an opportunity to live and work in Europe for a number of years. So probably over the past 30 years, you know, I've been living and working in Europe in different capacities. And so I tried to, in some ways, pick locations where some of these events could likely happen. It starts in the south of France. That's just happened to be where William Dresden is, but he's got to go all the way to London. And then there's an element that occurs in Marseille, and there's stuff that occurs in Germany. And eventually we end up in Strasbourg. So I was trying to pick the locations that maybe had historical relevance or maybe had power relevance for today of where things could be. Where could people hide? Where could people impact other groups or make this influence happen? And those are kind of how I picked those locations, as well as having lived or been there myself. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a scene that takes place in Tours, France, and I lived there for 3 months, and I enjoyed writing about the train station there, having used that train station a lot.
You write about Marseille, and you just mentioned it. We've never been any of the places. We're drooling, wanting to follow you all to these. To these places, not necessarily the experience, but the experience.
People chase us down the alley.
But Marseille, you write about Marseille, and you tell us tell us a little bit about your experience with Marseille.
So Marseille is an international crossroads. It's on the south of France. It's on the Mediterranean Sea, and there is a tremendous amount of international and foreign peoples that are all over. It's not just French. You have North Africans, you have people from the Middle East, you have people from other parts of Europe. And it was a trading city for the longest time under the French Empire. And they've been very independent for years and years and years. That's just an independent mindedness. But because of all these connections and all these different groups and peoples that are working there, there is an underbelly, there is an underside to Marseille, where a lot of criminal activity takes place, but in this story is taking place. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, one of those areas I enjoyed writing about, the smells of Marseille and the sights and how it feels. And when you feel like you're walking through these streets of cobblestones, it's a fascinating place.
Yeah.
You know, you bring in MI5, MI6, those famous famous terms from British intelligence. Would you explain those a little bit for us?
And how are they different? How do they differ?
So MI6 is the British Secret Intelligence Service, or BSIS, or MI6. And that is essentially the equivalent of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. That's the counterpart. Where MI5 is equivalent to our FBI, working domestically in England and across Britain. And they come out of, although they are staffed with majority civilians, they are, you know, military intelligence organizations. That's where they came out of in World War II and before that, you know, Intelligence 6. And that's what those groups are. And our characters run up against, well, Adeline is an MI6 officer. So.
Right.
In your experience, when you were in the service, did you work with folks in those organizations?
I did. I had the pleasure of working with a number of folks from MI6 and MI5. And they are wonderful partners. Really enjoyed working with them. And it was also exciting to work with people that were, you know, we were all on the same side working together, and to have that international connection and just the differences on how we would perceive operations and how they would perceive operations. And then we come together to do something jointly. It's a great relationship.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a moment ago about big data, and big data does obviously have a big role in this book. And part of the, and you mentioned AI and you mentioned ML, which was new to me, machine learning. I was happy in the book you said, oh, ML is machine learning. Oh, I learned something new. And there is a general understanding that the public, the unsuspecting public, we like false news, or we like, tell us how is it that, can you put your pulse on why do we gravitate to false news?
I think sometimes, whether it's false news or real news or perspective, we often like to have our ideas and beliefs reinforced. Mm. We like to think that, you know, if we have a certain perspective, we want that idea reinforced. So we're more likely to click on, you know, the proverbial click on your laptop or your phone on links or stories that are reinforcing our ideas, or that are the polar opposite. We'll focus on the polar opposite. So a lot of times these extremes can come out. And I think the best way to illustrate this is our phones. If you and I were standing next to each other and we clicked on some news site, we would get completely different feeds or streams of the types of stories that are coming out of there in our feed. We're going to get completely different things, because that's all based on what these companies are collecting with, is called ad all this information for our locations, our clicks, our buys, all this other types of stuff. That's all put together. So we're getting curated content sent to us. Well, what if I manipulated that content? What if I wanted you to think certain things so I can get in there with the algorithm? And now we have this big data and the cloud services and all these servers. And now I'm going to shape it to what I want you to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much of this is going on right now?
Have you checked your news feed recently?
Well, sometimes I wonder.
And I don't have a news feed. So he tells me.
I think a lot from the commercial side of things, we're getting fed through these algorithms and all the information that's out there that's been collected on us that we're freely giving away. I mean, this has been all over the news with Meta or Facebook or Google. Just there's all this information about this out there, and companies are using this to put us in positions where we're going to be at the most opportune time to buy something or to see this or to click on this video or something from YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's going on quite a bit. It's a huge moneymaker.
There's another term that you used that I was unfamiliar with, and you only used it once, but it got my attention. What is dark money?
Oh, dark money. Dark money's been around since the 70s. It's essentially where monies for organizations, I think it's a 501c4 is the technical type of entity that it is, where it's a nonprofit. donors, whether they're in the United States or international, can make donations to this nonprofit. And those identities don't have to be shared when this nonprofit then provides this money to a political campaign. So the reason it's called dark money is because we don't know who is providing the money and the donations to go into particular political campaigns or something like that. It's been around from the 70s, but I would say in the past 10 years, it has really become very prominent and getting pushed into both sides. You know, but it's not just one group or the other, you know, whether Republican or Democrat or independent. All are using this. But the concerning thing is we don't know where the money's coming from. So that's why it's called dark money.
We're now going to ask you, we're going to just throw out a few characters' names. We really are trying to avoid spoiler. We're trying to not do any spoilers so that our readers, and once again, readers, you want to read this book and the next and the and Landslide.
Yeah, readers, there's a lot of dangerous spots in this book.
So
we just can't tell you what they are.
So what we're going to do is we're going to throw out a name, and you can, if you don't want to say anything, Adam, you just say pass.
Sounds good.
If you want to say something, it's just, you know, a teaser, a little something to get us interested. So here's the first name, and you've already mentioned her before, Adeline Parker.
So she's the MI6 officer that teams up with William as they go up against the Strasbourg executive. And she's kind of on the outs with MI6. She's kind of doing her own thing, trying to sort through it. And she also has some familial connections to what's happening.
Do you want to ask one?
We get, well, who's Rupert? No,
Rupert
is a bad guy, good guy. He kind of depends on how you, what part you pick up in his life.
Rupert Isengard. So I like writing characters that are not clear-cut black and white, where there's gray. So depending how you read what he's involved in, and he was a teacher of William when he was very young in England. And we eventually come across this individual, but we're not sure if he's good or bad or where he kind of falls.
Yeah. How about Sophia?
Oh, she's a baddie.
From the very beginning, right?
You'll meet her very quick in the book.
Yes, and she will.
She's got some baggage that just makes her a very evil person.
And there were several times we've shared this before on the show. We have a small house, one couch, you know, in the small living room, and I sit at one end and Jim at the other, and I would go, "Oh no!" And he'd look over and I say, "It's just Sophia. It's Sophia."
I have to say to the readers, we're talking about she's a bad lady, but you know, there's really some twists and turns to her life. There's a real spoiler alert.
Yeah.
That's it.
We got it. Okay. How about Sir Alfred Graham?
So this is Adeline's boss at MI6. And I kind of modeled him off some of the experiences I had, but one I think the most interesting was is for a time I was working in East Africa, and I got to work at this or not work at, but I got to go to this place called the Muthiga Club, and it was a club made for the plantation owners back in the colonial area, where the farmers coming up plantations could go to this club. It was for all men, and it was only for men at the time. Women weren't allowed in, and now they are. But I got to visit this place, and as I was trying to craft this gentleman, Sir Alfred Graham, that's who was in my mind, as someone who would write in a club like that.
Okay, we have time for one more. We have this person or Faust.
Oh, Faust. Faust is a multi-layered character, and I can't claim credit for drawing the connection, but it's definitely a part of the Faustian bargain, where Faust is someone who has come face to face and made a deal with the devil.
Yeah, and there are twists and turns with Faust that will just leave you stunned, and you have to get up and go get a drink or something and let it like percolate in your mind. Adam, we like to kind of take a little, it's not really a break here, but we love to talk to our guest about how did you find Rendezvous with a Writer, and can you share a little bit about your experience getting with us?
So I've always loved talk radio. When I lived in Virginia, when I was still with the agency, that was my morning commute, listening to talk radio. So I move out here to LA, and I would look for talk radio stations. And also being a writer, I would look for stuff that was writing focused. And so I listened to one of your episodes with Andrews and Wilson, who are two of my favorite authors. And they just came out, a little plug for them, they just came out with Act of Defiance, which is essentially the continuation of the Hunt for Red October in the Clancy series. Yeah. And so my copy arrived yesterday. I cannot wait to open it up. But I really enjoyed your conversation with Brian and Jeff. It was a wonderful conversation. I love the format. And so that's how I found you and started listening to you. And then as underhanded was getting ready to be published, I said, well, I wonder if they'd let me come on the show. So that's when I sent you an email and humbly asked if you would allow me to come aboard.
Yeah. And we figured it out time-wise and all. And it's, again, we've been looking forward to, we look forward to every one of our time with our guests, but we've been particularly looking forward to this with you. And we've also been kind of putting it out there that we are looking for sponsors. It's wonderful to have sponsors to come along and support what we're doing. And we would like to announce our first one. So Blue Cottage Agency has come along as a sponsor. They represent and promote books, writers, and the literary arts as a whole. And Clicks by Madison, creative design, graphics, and logos. We've been working with them for a while. They've done our social media. When you see our social media graphics, Adam, there was a special one for you, and we sent it to you before the month was started, so you could use it if you wanted to promote the show. And we've been working with them for a while and have absolutely loved the opportunity, and now they've kind of come along as a sponsor. So welcome, Blue Cottage Agency. And they're right now, they're working on a new logo.
Wonderful.
So we got that coming sometime down the pike. Let's see. Okay. So now, all right.
Do we want to talk about William a little bit more?
Yeah, you'll go ahead and ask about, William or maybe his dad?
William's dad. Yeah, his dad was a really nice guy. William had a tough time, right? Working with his dad?
William's father haunts him through the whole book. And that's some of the, it's not a spoiler because I think it happens on page 4.
Yeah.
But William's father, from what William believed, died in a car crash in Paris back in the 90s, about 20 years ago. But when Adeline first meets him, she says it wasn't a car crash, it wasn't an accident. He was killed, and that's kind of what launches us on this journey, this rocket ship.
William, Professor William, he's kind of a multi-layered character. At first I read about him, I think, well, he's a professor and he teaches history and, he's an academic guy. But then we kind of find out, wait a minute, he's a rugby player. Those guys play football with no pads. This guy is not a multi.
Well, I wanted to give him a little bit of a background that could justify some of the things that I wanted him to do later on. But he's in some ways, some elements of him are inspired by a professor that I had, who I met years ago. And when I was in Bosnia with the Marines, this real professor was there working in orphanages in Sarajevo. Uh-huh. And we met, years later is when he and I met, but we had that common connection and bond. And so I thought that was a very good element for William's background, that he wasn't just, he'd done more than go from, graduate school to PhD to start teaching, that he had a little bit of international experience that would have been a little rough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's, physically he's tougher than one might expect, but he also rises that adrenaline just, he rises to the occasion. Occasions. Let's ask, I guess I didn't think to ask this of you earlier, but when you're writing a thriller or an espionage thriller, are there certain elements that you as a writer need to be sure that are included because the reader will be expecting them or because the genre sort of expects it?
I think, but yeah, particularly with espionage thrillers, there you always have to have some type of mystery. You always have to have some type of mystery that is trying to be uncovered, that the characters are trying to either understand or figure out. But there has to also be duplicity. There has to be this lying going back and forth, because that is the world of espionage. You know, there's lying, cheating, stealing, and manipulating of what we're trying to do to steal secrets. So to have that element, I think, is critical. And it's also the relationships of the people. Spies in real life are some pretty interesting characters. They can do all these different things. So you got to have some engaging personalities in your story.
Yeah. When you sit down to read, take off your writer's hat and say, okay, I'm going to be a reader now. Do you read this genre? And if so, is that how do you approach the material as a reader?
I do. I'd say about 50% of what I read is in this genre. And I've read it my entire life. I grew up with Clancy and Robert Ludlum and all those folks, and really love it. And I'm also one to believe that, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So I'll read people from all different backgrounds who are writing these spy thrillers. And I know some of them reading them, it's unrealistic. It would never happen in the real world. But that doesn't take away from me from the entertainment value, because I'm reading it because I want to have a good story. I want sometimes there to be that little bit element of disbelief, because, that's exciting. I'm looking to escape when I'm doing this. So, yeah, about 50% of what I read is in the spy thriller genre. The other 50%, though, is all over the place. Very diverse reader. Like I was saying earlier, right now I'm reading Stephen King. Huge fan of Amor Tolles, Margaret Atwood, Ernest Hemingway. Writers from all different backgrounds, I really enjoy what they do. And I like having that very diverse series of books that I'm able to go through, because they influence me in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked that technology plays a big role in this particular story. How do you keep on top of, so you're timely, since this is set right now in contemporary times, how in the 2 years that it took you to get it, published, were there things that happened where you're like, oh, I've got to go back and I need to change that app name, or
whatever? I think, yeah, Twitter changed to X. In the process at one point. I said, well, I'm just going to kind of keep that because we were already in the production process.
Yeah.
But, excuse me, writers like Andrews and Wilson, Jack Carr, James Rollins, they are very good at bringing into all this technical information on how they, Tom Clancy was a pioneer in the techno thriller genre, and they had all this technical information going on there, which is fascinating. I love reading it, but that's not the writing that I do. I want to be able to address and explore some of the technology issues, because technology is all around us right now. I want to be able to do that, but I also want to do it in a way that won't be outdated in a year from now. And for me, so I've got to kind of look at this and say, okay, how can I talk about this? How can I include this in my story, but to where somebody who's really steeped in the technology isn't going to try to poke holes in it? So I try to keep it at a higher level with the generalities when it comes to artificial intelligence or machine learning or big data, and describe these events or put them into the plot in a way that, okay, that's plausible, and it's going to last for 5 or 10 years, hopefully.
I know you have a question.
We always like to ask this one, particularly with your characters, do they ever surprise you?
All the time. I'm a plotter, so I do outline my manuscript, but I know by a quarter of the way into it, a halfway into writing the manuscript, the characters, if I'm doing it right, they start taking on a life of their own and they start telling me the story. And even though I thought I was going right, the characters are telling me, no, we're going to go left. And you've got to be open to that. You've got to, because if you've created their backstory, if you've created their personalities and their motivations and their perspectives, if you've done that well, they are going to tell you how they will react in a situation. And I think it's really important as a writer to make sure we stay true to that.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Adeline, and I'm thinking, you know, one spot, I'm thinking, we're going to take this guy out right now.
And there's that time William passed. I can't say anymore. And I often wonder when you create or you author have to take somebody out, is that a hard decision or it just propels the story forward and it just has to happen?
I think it is a tough decision. Because if you've written a character well, even if they're just a secondary or tertiary character, they have a little bit of a life in them. And so when you remove them, you're taking an element of the story away. You know, George R.R. Martin in the Game of Thrones, he killed off all my heroes in the first book. And I was like, what is going on here? But that created this epic story that we followed these other characters that just became just as brilliant. So it is a challenge for me. In Landslide, a character is killed off. I'm not sure if you've gotten there yet, but you'll find out that a character is killed there. And I've had so many comments about that person being killed.
I must not have gotten there yet. Another gripping story. I also wanted to ask. Now I'm looking at time. We're almost out of time. I did have another question though. Why did you choose? So many questions we're not going to get to. Why did you decide to choose William, to write William in the first person?
So that was a carryover from Landslide. And what happened was when I was writing Landslide, my agent, who's very talented in the business, Judy Kapaj, she was reading my work because I originally wrote it in third person. And she said, Adam, you have all these experiences and you have all this trauma that you're trying to explore through your writing and through your books. Switch this to first person because you are then going to get a very intimate experience with these characters. So that's what I did in Landslide. And that's what I tried to do with The Underhanded. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have that personal connection with the reader. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, wanted to add the perspective of other characters. Mm-hmm. So they're in third person because I didn't want William to know everything that was going on because we never know all the information.
Yeah.
That's why I chose that.
There's obviously there's a cliffhanger and it's a cliffhanger. And there is a character who makes it out alive, although we're not really quite sure what's happened to that character. But because it's a cliffhanger, I'm assuming there is a sequel coming.
There is a sequel in the works right now. Okay. So writing it, plotting it out, and I've started writing it. So yes, there will be a sequel.
Tell us, Adam, where our readers can find you, follow you, where they can find your books and all that good stuff.
So my website is adamsykes.com, and I have a newsletter that you can sign up for. It's called The Black Cash. And I talk about other writing in the genre, other books that I think are really, really wonderful or something that people should pick up, realistic, or they do something unique. So that's in the newsletter. But I'm also on social media, Instagram at Adam_R_Sykes, Adam R. Sykes. Same thing on X and Threads. So that's where you can find me.
And you have a couple quotes.
We do have a couple quotes.
Let's get right to them.
You know, this is from the book. This is from Professor William. He's thinking, you know, he's in conversation with Special Agent Adeline Baker. And he's thinking, but the notion that there is a secret group of businessmen, generals, aristocrats who work behind the scenes for over a century in pursuit of European superiority was incredible. It ranked up there with the conspiracy theories about the Knights Templar or Hitler's fascination with the occult. Randall is a truth that had been blown to absurd proportions. Kind of sets the story. Ian, we have one from Ian Fleming, the James Bond writer, who says, history is moving pretty quickly these days, and the heroes and villains keep changing parts.
We've been talking with our special guest, Adam Sykes, about The Underhanded, his newest book. We didn't really get to Landslide, but we know we'll have him back when sequels are done. And next week, our guest will be Anne Schroeder. We'll be talking about her newest book that just came out this month, Crossroads in Casa Corte, as well as the first of a three-book series, The Bundling Year. And that's with Anne next week. Adam, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you to all of you that have come along for the ride. And do you have a closing thought?
It's always a great day out west. Thank you.
Keep writing. We'll keep reading. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.